Good morning. I was trying to come up with a good story to tell you about my black eye here. Some of you, it may be far away, it might just look like eyeshadow on one side. I am from Berkeley, but that is not what it is. I was going to try and tell you a good story, but the truth is it's my four-year-old, I have a four-year-old son. And if you've ever had a four-year-old son, that's probably enough said. But for those of you, I thought it was time to put on pajamas. He thought it was time to be a frog. But the point is, my son was born in Rochester, New York, like Lucy mentioned. My wife and I served a congregation there. And every year this time, I am so glad to be back home in California. Because those of you who have lived in a place like Rochester know that this month is a hard month in many parts of our country. And things happen there, and I especially want to ask any kids who are here, do you know about this thing that happens this time of year in other places called a blizzard? Have you ever heard of that? This is a story about a blizzard I want to tell you. And I need a little bit of help making some noises in this story. You'll know when. So Anna lived on a farm. She grew up on a farm. And she had the responsibility every morning to go out and take care of the animals. So Anna would go out and she would take care of the chickens. Thank you. Yes, yeah. Very good. And she would feed the chickens. And then she would take care of the goat. Oh, yes, very good. It was a very loud goat. And then she would take care of the cows. She'd milk the cows. Yeah, very good. And then she would take care of the ducks. There were ducks on this farm, too. Ah, excellent. Oh, and maybe one pig. Yeah, she'd bathe that pig in buttermilk. I don't know why I think that. I think from Charlotte's Web. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I've never taken care of a pig, but Anna did every morning. And one morning, when Anna got up and opened the door to go out and take care of the animals, there was a blizzard. And she couldn't see hardly past a foot out the door. Everything was white, white as snow, the whole sky. She couldn't see her hand in front of her face. And so Anna was scared. But she remembered about what her grandfather had told her. Because she was scared, but she also knew that those animals needed her. They needed her. Even though there was a blizzard, no one else was going to go out and take care of those animals. It needed to be Anna. So she remembered what her grandfather told her, that there was a rope that they would tie when there was going to be a blizzard. A rope tied from the back door out to the barn, and that if she just reached out and grabbed hold of the rope, she would be safe. So while the blizzard was storming all around her, oh, very good. Anna was grabbing onto the rope and striding out to the barn. She got there. She fed the chickens. She took care of the donkey. She milked the cows, she fed the ducks, she bathed the pig in buttermilk, and then she grabbed hold of that rope. And the blizzard around her, while it blew strong, she could make her way home, holding on to the rope. So I hope that if you ever find yourself lost in a blizzard of any kind, there's a rope for you to hold on to.
At the kitchen table one night when I was 14, my dad said, "Hey, buddy, want to go for a ride after dinner?" One of the guys at the airstrip had recommended a shop where lots of airplane parts were in stock and sold at a discount. The planes I'm talking about were meticulously hand-built, highly detailed, flyable radio control scale models. The hundreds of small parts that made them fly were both expensive and hard to find. There was no Google back then. So Dad was pretty excited. The drive took us to a part of town I hadn't been to before. We finally turned onto a side street leading into a neighborhood of very modest homes. "Here it is," Dad said. No sign. Just a house with lots of tire tracks across the graveled front yard. So we parked there. The house had a large plate glass window and an entry door like those little shops of the past. When the door opened, a little bell jingled, announcing our arrival. We had walked into a surprisingly big living room, but it was filled not with furnishings, but glass display cases like you might see in an old jewelry store. They were arranged around the perimeter of the room with just enough space for the proprietor to move around his side of the counter. A very large man entered through curtains that gave their kitchen a little privacy in the next room. He rolled up and extended a huge hand to each of us in turn. I say rolled up because his mobility was aided by a heavy-duty red tricycle fitted with an oversized padded seat. He seemed to have limited use of his legs. Friendly and knowledgeable, this guy and my dad were soon talking propellers, servos, linkages. I demonstrated classic teen disinterest. When the receipt was written up and the bill paid, our host called to his wife, "Honey, come in and share your testimony." A very tall, rather plain-looking woman stepped through those curtains from the kitchen, wearing a tired house dress. Filled with faith, she enthusiastically recounted her story. "I was lost," she said, "doing the work of the devil, giving men pleasure to get money for drugs." I stood in stunned silence, stealing glances at my dad, who was as surprised as I, but doing a much better job acting natural. "I would surely have died," she continued, "but for Jesus and his love. At my lowest point, I prayed to Jesus to deliver me. He lifted me up, and I was saved. I got off the drugs, and eventually I found my way off the streets, and finally, he led me to my husband. Praise the Lord." In our Jewish household, Dad freely expressed his very well-reasoned opinions. That night, he just stood in silence, which I couldn't understand. Eventually, we said our goodbyes and got out the door, which had hardly closed behind us when I could no longer stand it. Dad, White, he interrupted me with some sort of a nonverbal sign. He quickly nixed the questions until we were in the car. "Why didn't you say anything? I know you don't believe all that. You don't, do you?" In an earnest voice, he replied, "You saw how they're living. They don't have much, do they?" "No," I responded. "Let's say you took issue with their faith and prevailed. What would they be left with?" Shame washed over me. 50 years later, I still squirm, reflecting my inclination to ridicule or question. It was a very quiet ride home. Today, I grasp that these kind people wished only to share the greatest gift they had experienced with two strangers who happened to come through their door. My dad seized a teachable moment that night to demonstrate how he lived his values, hoping that they would perhaps become mine. He had no reprimand for me. He just wanted to show me how to act with respect for the worth and dignity of every person and the diversity that makes our world whole. I get it, Dad. I get it.
"The Way It Is," "The Way It Is" by William Stafford. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. While you hold on to it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. My wife was having one of those days, back-to-back meetings, everything packed in just right, just tight, back-to-back, and she was on her way from one appointment to another when she took a wrong left turn and ended up in a cemetery. And she said later to me that, I kid you not, my first thought was, that's just how life is. You take one wrong turn and you end up in the graveyard. But something that day spoke to her, spoke within her. She took a deep breath, and rather than flipping on the GPS and course correcting immediately, she actually decided to cancel her next appointment to stop, park the car, get out, and take a walk on a beautiful day in a cemetery. There's an app you can download for your phone called GPS for the Soul. It's a nice little app. It has lovely meditations and little calming, peaceful music. You probably have your own app like this. If you're anything like me, you never use it. It's there, though, on your phone, available to you. Pictures of trees and mountains and things come up. But the truth is, as lovely as an app like that is, there is no GPS for the soul. There's no map to the vast reaches of our inner lives. The territory of the soul cannot be navigated by turn-by-turn directions. And sometimes this truth is a breath of fresh air on a busy day. Sometimes it liberates you from back-to-back appointments, allows you, like my wife did that day, to take a walk in the sun. It's the liberating truth that asks us again and again, what if on life's journey, on the spiritual path, there are no wrong turns? And in Unitarian Universalism, it is this truth. There is no GPS for the soul. There is no map. This truth that we hold on to guard against dogma, the rigid maps of religious traditions that proclaim there is one way and only one way. But sometimes we find ourselves like Anna in the blizzard, desperate for a map, a guide, a rope, a thread to follow. Have you been there? Do you know what I'm talking about? That place of lost and longing, that place where the woman in Jed's story described. In times like these, our find-your-own-way faith can feel weak and feeble. In times like these, our truth that there is no GPS for your life's journey can be disappointing, if not devastating. In the introduction to his book, A Hidden Wholeness, Parker Palmer, one of our great teachers, our great contemporary teachers, the Quaker spiritual guide, he talks about that rope that farmers used in the Great Plains to keep from getting lost in the blizzard. And he writes this, that today we live in a blizzard of another sort. It swirls around us as economic injustice, ecological ruin, physical and spiritual violence, and their inevitable outcome, war. It swirls within us as fear and frenzy, greed and deceit, and indifference to the suffering of others. We all know stories of people who have wandered off into this madness and been separated from their own souls, losing their moral bearings and even their mortal lives. Some of us fear that we or those we love will become lost in the storm. Some are lost at this moment and trying to find the way home. Some are lost without knowing it. We do live in anxious and uncertain times. Some days it seems like our whole world is on the brink of disaster. Even when we are grounded in ourselves and connected to those we love, we find ourselves struggling to make our way through the blizzard of the world. This is one of the core questions that every religious tradition struggles to answer. What do you do with evil, with suffering? How do we understand it? There's a word, I know you all are exploring UU theology for the 21st century this year. I don't know if you know that. But that's what I was told, I was invited to come be part of. We struggle, Unitarian Universalists, we struggle with how to talk about suffering and evil. We've been criticized, rightly so, for our inability to talk about it. In Buddhism, it's the first noble truth. Life is laced with dukkha, with suffering. There is suffering. It's unavoidable. In Christianity, in the dominant frames of our culture's religious references, conversation is, of course, about how do Christians talk about evil? Sin, original sin, yeah? That sin and salvation, those threads of original sin are woven, I think, so deeply into our culture, we can buy into them without knowing that's what we're even doing. And as liberal religionists, we've talked about an alternative of original blessing, that we are inherently good, that our bodies are good, our sexualities are good, that there's not this inherent sinfulness about us. But I think in doing so, in talking about original blessing, we've actually failed to address the question that original sin wrestles with. Why do we suffer so much? Why is there so much evil in the world? And so I would invite us, I think, instead to talk about not original blessing, but original struggle that we are born into and inherit, a struggle, a suffering that every generation of humanity has faced. Systems of oppression, family systems of chaos and despair. We do inherit this. It's part of what it means to be human, and that is the good news, that this original struggle, it connects us to everyone who is living, everyone who has ever lived. In my first few months at college, 17 years old and 3,000 miles from home, I was as lost in the blizzard as I've ever been. My personal sorrows and pain over the state of the world had collided to land me in a deep and lasting depression. After spending a week receiving care in an inpatient mental health unit, I returned home lost and defeated. For weeks that became months, I remember struggling to even spend moments alone, to leave the house. And I'll never forget the first Sunday that I came back to the Unitarian Universalist Church of my childhood. I was bursting with tears throughout the whole service, and as I wept with the sorrow of the world's woes, I was gently and warmly enfolded into the loving embrace of my community. What saved me, what healed me, what made me whole, it was not psychiatrists or the time at the hospital or pharmaceuticals or therapists or exercise, though those were all helpful. What saved me was a religious community, a religious tradition that told me to seek support anywhere I could find it, to open to Buddhist teachings of mindfulness, as well as to the wisdom of scientific traditions of psychology and psychiatry. What saved me was a religious community that told me with so much more than words, you are loved. No matter what you do, or what you think, or how you feel, you are loved. When I couldn't hold the thread for myself, my community held it for me. When I had given up on my own inner guide, what Parker Palmer would name as the soul's order, my religious tradition tied a rope to the barn so I could find my way home. A few more words of Parker Palmer's. My own experience of the blizzard, which includes getting lost in it more often than I like to admit, tells me that the soul's order can never be destroyed. It may be obscured by the whiteout. We may forget or deny that its guidance is close at hand, and yet we are still in the soul's backyard, with chance after chance to regain our bearings. Have you ever walked a labyrinth? I know you probably have heard plenty about labyrinths, knowing Lucy. I'm not talking about the kind with all the confusing turns and wrong choices and deadly minotaur chasing you, but that kind that we have in so many of our congregations, or the kind that's laid into the marble floor at Chart Cathedral. I've never been to Chart, but I've walked reproductions of that labyrinth many times. There's no wrong turns when you're walking the labyrinth. Walking the labyrinth, the only place to go is in, deeper and deeper toward the center. In the labyrinth, even when it feels as though you're moving away from the center, you're still moving in. It's the only way to go. The church that welcomed me with open arms knew the truth that I couldn't hold for myself. The congregation saw me through the turns of my winding labyrinth, even as I was certain I had taken a wrong turn. Ours is not a dogma that becomes irrelevant, not a guidebook or a set of directions or a map out of the maze. It is a thread to hold along the labyrinth. Its guarantee is not that it will lead you anywhere in particular, but that you will be held along the way, that you are not traveling alone, that others have walked this path before you and others will follow, that there is a center and wholeness to this journey, even when it is hidden from view. Unitarian Universalists, we are a people following the thread. We are a tradition, a living tradition following the thread. Yes, you have to explain this to others, and it is hard for them to see. And while you hold on to this tradition, this thread, you are not alone. Tragedies happen. People get hurt and die. We all suffer and get old. And here, holding on to this thread together, we navigate the blizzard. We do all of this in community. And really, it is very difficult to explain in casual conversations. We talk about our elevator speeches. You talk about elevator speeches here? Trying to express what Unitarian Universalism is and the time it takes to take an elevator ride. I think it's hard to explain about what this faith is anytime I don't have my 20 uninterrupted minutes to give a sermon. But we are asked to do this. One time we were in a conversation, Emily and I, with her midwife, one of our midwives we were working with. And she asked about Emily's profession. And upon hearing she was a minister, the nurse asked about her faith. She wanted to know more about Unitarian Universalism. So Emily explained, Unitarian, which means I believe in one source, that we're all connected. And knowing that she was talking to somebody who used God language, she said, "A universalist, which means I believe in a loving God that would not and cannot damn anyone to hell." "Well," she replied after a moment's pause, "I'm a Christian, which means I believe in a loving God too, but he has standards." You can just imagine our jaws dropping. Oh, it was one of those times when you look for the what you were supposed to say much later. We crowdsourced the question to our Facebook friends, many of whom are our UU ministers. The best response, well, it came back, "Well," she should have said, in our tradition, we have standards for God." Now, of course, that's not what we're going to say when we show up with Jed's family friends. But we do. We have standards for God. We have standards for God or for any ultimate truth. So many of us are drawn to this faith because of a powerful no. We say no to a patriarchal God, no to a fairy tale God, no to a God with a magic wand or an all-seeing GPS for our lives. No to dogmatic religion, no to religious shame or guilt for not believing a particular way, and underneath those no's, I think, runs a course of deeper yeses. There is a thread we follow. Lucy and my teacher, the UU theologian Rebecca Parker, who was longtime president of our seminary, Star King, she articulates four strands that form the core of our theological thread. Four boundaries, four places where our theology says no in order to say a deeper yes. First, she says, you can hold a view that there is no God or that God exists. But you cannot hold the view that God is the all-powerful determiner of everything that happens, such that there is no exercise of human freedom. Unitarian Universalism is clear that there is some measure of freedom accessible to every living being given in the nature of things. Our thread is freedom. Second, you can define salvation, healing, and wholeness in many ways. But you cannot hold that the view that there will be an ultimate separation of the saved from the damned, by which the good are rewarded with eternal bliss and the damned are punished with eternal suffering. Unitarian Universalism is clear that all souls are of worth. Our thread is salvation, healing, and wholeness that is universal for everyone. Third, you can be devoted to a specific religious practice, such as Christian prayer or Buddhist meditation or pagan ritual, but you cannot hold the view that there is one religion that encompasses the exclusive final truth for all times and places, not even Unitarian Universalism. We are confident that revelation is not sealed. Our thread is openness, is continuing to learn and grow. And finally, Parker says, you can see this world as tragically flawed, wondrously gifted, or both, but you cannot hold the view that salvation is to be found solely beyond this world, in some life after death or world other than this world. Our Unitarian Universalist faith is clear that the ultimate is present here and now. Our thread is this world, this life. Our thread is here and now. I sometimes talk about these threads as the theology of connection. In the face of all our inner blizzards, all that pulls each of us apart and threatens the wholeness of our souls, connection is the thread we follow. If your beliefs lead you to be more connected to your deepest self, to others in your family, your workplace, your church, your great earth community. If your beliefs lead you to be more connected than they're in. If they lead you to be disconnected, to treat others poorly or question your own value, then those beliefs are out. No to all that separates us, yes to connection. That's Unitarian Universalism. Our thread is as simple as that. We know the world is in a troubled state. The blizzard of despair and injustice and environmental catastrophe is real. It was real before our current president. It will be real after our current president. The blizzard is real, and so too is the thread. Hold on to the thread, not just for your own life, but for the world. Not just for your own life, but for this life-giving, life-saving religious tradition. This thread of freedom, of healing, and wholeness that is for everyone. This thread of staying open to new learning and new truth, the way to remember that what matters most is this life, this world, this here and now. Our thread connects us to generations of love and action, generation of approaching the questions of religion and spirituality with reason, with the intellectual rigor required for the age of information, generations of making the food and telling the story and doing the ritual so that deep connections can be forged, connections that are deep enough so that the next time a 17-year-old or a 70-year-old walks through your doors with only despair in their heart, they find that they are enfolded in the embrace of love. They find that though they are journeying through the blizzard, they journey not alone. May it be so. And amen.